Okay, so we're ready to start. In case you did not know, my name is Ariel Fenster. But it's a great pleasure that today we have a special guest, Thomas Gervais from École Polytechnique in Montreal. Thomas Gervais does very much what we do here at the Office for Science and Society, but out of École Polytechnique and out of French. And in particular, he's very much involved in TV work. He's with Télé-Québec. He's involved with Le Code Chastenet. Great show if you get a chance to see it. And the reason I asked Thomas to come today is that I had the opportunity to share the stage with him two summers ago at Festival Eureka in Old Montreal. It's a great, it's every summer in June. If you get a chance, it's really worth going there. There are all sort of exhibition, all sort of activity. And I was very much impressed with his presentation on microwaves, and I realized how little I knew about microwaves, so I thought if I know little, you don't know more. Well, that would be really a great presentation for you to have. So without any further ado, I'll let Thomas take over.
All right, start that. Great, so thanks for coming, and my turn to introduce you to our two extreme microwave engineers here, Etienne and Wendy Julie. They're both master's students in engineering physics at Polytechnique. And what I'm about to show you today is basically a mix between the lecture that I gave at the Festival Eureka a few years ago and several experiments that are ongoing. So there's a student club that does these experiments of, you know, what if I microwave that? And then they put it in the microwave, see what happens. And this is what we're going to do today. But there's certainly a pedagogical twist that I put to it because I intend to teach you some physics using the microwave and using everything you can do. Actually, everything you could do yourself at home. But I've titled my talk, Don't Do It Yourself Microwave Recipes. And there's a reason for that. I'm going to explain in a minute. So probably most of you never took the 2 minutes required to read the instruction manual for a microwave. It's getting easier and easier to use. You press the quick minute button, and then you get it 1 minute, and that's it. And you wait, and then you have your warm coffee. But actually, if you look in the manual, there's always this kind of warning. And it's pretty harsh, actually. It says you can be killed or seriously injured if you don't immediately follow instructions. So this is something not to mess with, according to them. And I would just like to comment a little bit on these kind of instruction. We're going to do things that, according to this manual, could get us killed immediately. So I just want to put some caveats on what they're saying. Is it really a death hazard? Well, if you do that at home, it's highly unlikely that you're going to die, first thing. However, the most likely chance that you're going to die is if you play with the transformer and all the power and you get electrocuted. This is something that can happen. You're, however, very likely to burn or hurt yourself or someone else. Sometimes if you put things in microwaves that are not water-based, such as glass, for example, it can become really, really warm, like 500 degrees Celsius, and you don't see it. And if you grab the glass, you can hurt yourself. So this is likely. Breaking the microwave oven, very likely. We broke several microwave ovens while doing these experiments, so be aware of that too. And the last, which is almost certain, you're going to make a mess. You're going to break things, blow them up, and probably spill stuff all over the kitchen, so definitely going to make a mess. So the conclusion is, what we're going to show today is the result of several hours of practice and a good understanding of what happens inside the microwave. We're going to show you some parts of it. So don't do this at home. There's one experiment that we're going to have you try at home if you want. But for the rest, don't do it at home and respect the manufacturer's instructions. It's important. I don't want to be accused of, you know, causing indirect death by microwave. Okay, and just I want to start with a very quick historical introduction. So the first microwave oven was invented by someone, by an engineer called Percy Spencer in the 40s, was patented, made him rich. And Percy Spencer was working for the company Raytheon. Has anyone heard of that company before? One person. Only one? You know what Raytheon does? Anyone knows?
Radars,
mostly. It started doing radars. Now it does military supply for the U.S. military, essentially. So he was working on a radar, actually, and realized that when he was setting the radar and starting, he had a chocolate in his pocket, the legend says, at some point, and he realized that the chocolate quickly melted. So he realized that you could actually heat stuff with those microwave radars, and he patented it. And this is one of the first microwaves that came on the market in the 50s. It was called a radar range, not surprisingly. So basically radar cooking. And it was about $5,000 at the time. Would weigh, you know, like pretty much like a fridge. And basically would consume about 3 kilowatts, which is way more than your power outlet at home can provide. And with time, you know, microwave got smaller and smaller and simpler, but always shared the same mechanism. And recently, there was news on the internet of this miniature Beanzawave, which is was invented by Heinz, and it's supposedly a USB microwave. But if you look at it, actually, there's a trick, because a USB power supply provides about 2.5 watts of power, which is it's way too small to heat anything with that. So there's actually a battery in the Beanzawave, and the USB recharges the battery, which in turn then can microwave stuff. But the thing, actually, I tried to buy one, and I realized that there was lots of promotion around that in 2009, but it has yet to be marketed, so they probably figured that people didn't really need a USB microwave after all. Okay, so that's for our little history. And see, you have some extremely small, the huge ones, but the principle has remained the same since the very beginning. And this is one of our deceased microwaves that we autopsied. And you can, actually, there's several pieces, but what you quickly realize is that most of the weight from the microwave comes from the transformer. This is more than 5 kilograms, you know, it's like a block of steel. So this is the way it works is pretty simple. So when you plug your microwave oven, this is a power transformer, so you create a very high voltage, which is applied to a piece called the magnetron inside, which is right here. And what this does is, essentially, you're heating up using these metal wires here, you're heating up these wires, and this is attached right on top of a big magnet, and those wires will emit electrons. And the electrons, when they're close to a magnet, you know what they do? Anyone has any idea of what? Like in your old TV set, for example, an old TV set is typically an electron cannon, which shoots electron, and then they're deflected using a magnet. So anything that is charged that moves by a magnet feels a force, Lorentz force, and gets deflected. And that's what happened. And you start inducing swirling currents of electron in this piece. And then it is set just the right size, actually, with holes nearby here. And it's just the right size so as to create a resonant cavity. Exactly like in a flute, for example, when you have acoustic waves, you blow in the flute and the tube resonates and emits one precise pitch, you know, one note. Here it's the same thing. It's got just the right size to create an electromagnetic wave, which is essentially electrons wiggling around in the magnetic field that creates that. And then this is sent through the waveguide, which is just a metal tube about this big at the top of the microwave, and into the microwave chamber here. And this is all encased in metal. Anyone has an idea of why?
To shield the radiation inside the microwave.
To shield the radiation first. So, by the way, feel free to interrupt if you have any questions. And I often ask, so don't be shy to raise your hand or to, you know, try out my questions. So what happens is that those waves are actually, they get reflected by metal. And so in this chamber here, not only do you shield the outside from the waves, but also you concentrate the energy into that chamber so that every wave that comes in bounces around and ends up being absorbed by what we call the load here. So basically whatever food or material you're putting in your microwave is going to absorb the energy at the end. So it's actually a very simple system. And so there's a tray here, and the tray is usually rotating because, as you'll see very soon, there are some hot spots in your microwave and some cold spots. And since you don't want to have half your chicken burnt and the other uncooked, then it's better to just move it around in the microwave. Okay, and a typical frequency for a microwave here is 2.45 gigahertz, which surprisingly is actually, or maybe not surprisingly, it's the exact same frequency as a Wi-Fi router and in the same range as cell phone, essentially. So it's the same kind of waves that power both. Yes, question?
I don't know where the transformer is in this picture.
The transformer is here. So in this part, well, it's hard to say from this, it's probably here. But I don't know, then it should be connected. No, that's the power for this. So it's either here or simply here right after the power supply, probably here. Other questions? So the first thing I want to do with you, just before a little survey, who has an undergraduate major in science here? About half. Who does not do science at the university, the college level? Okay, so the talk is very general, and I just want to show some basic principles. So the first thing, I just want to see if you have any idea. If I tell you, so these waves, these electromagnetic waves, have a frequency of 2.45 million hertz, meaning that the field is oscillating 2.45 million times per second. What would the wavelength of these microwaves be? So, unfortunately, the clickers aren't functioning as I... actually, we didn't find them, so we'll have to function the old-fashioned way. So, who says 112 nanometers? And I want that the sum of the hands equal the sum of people inside the room at the end. Okay, so, anyone? 12 nanometers? Okay. 12 micrometers. About half. 12 millimeters. Maybe 10 people. 12 centimeters. 1, 2, 3. 3 people. 4. And 12 meters in the end. One person. So if you win everything. That's good. Okay, so well, actually the answer is, and you can calculate it very easily, 12 centimeters. So it's kind of confusing that microwaves are actually in the centimeter range. Well, actually, they're usually a microwave has a wavelength between 1 millimeter and 1 meter. They're not micrometer long. Micrometer waves are infrared waves, essentially. So it's kind of tricky. And you can actually calculate it, and I'll show you the formula to calculate the relationship between wavelength and frequency in a minute. Okay? So, but before that, I just want to discuss a little bit what is a microwave, and for that show a nice electromagnetic spectrum that I found on the NASA website, and actually to realize that microwaves are nothing but light that is at such an extreme low frequency that we can't see it. It's actually, so here's the spectrum. On the right side, you have the very, very short wavelengths. Look at the gamma rays, 10 to the negative 12, that's in meters. So that's much smaller than a hydrogen atom. That's about the size of a nucleus. And we don't know anything that small here. Okay, so it's really, really short wavelength. And the shorter the wavelength, the higher the frequency, the more energy it carries. But it's still an electromagnetic wave. It's still the oscillation of something charged that makes these waves. So if you go here from gamma, then you go to less energy, you get X-rays, UVs, and then you get into the visible. On this side of the visible, this is known as ionizing radiation, which means that if you send a photon, one quantum of light, say, for a gamma ray or X-ray, onto a molecule, it's very likely to break it apart. UVs can also break molecules apart, and that's why you get suntan in the summer, or you can get also melanoma if you're overexposed to UV light. Then you get into the visible spectrum, and on the other side is the infrared. This is the micron scale here. And then you get into the microwaves area here, and even less energy you find the radio waves and then the extreme low frequency spectrum over here. So this is what essentially a microwave is. It's light, but at such a low frequency that you can't see it. But it's the same, the exact same phenomenon. Okay? So you can calculate the relationship, and that is true for any electromagnetic wave. You can calculate the relationship between the frequency and the wavelength because the product of the two gives you the speed at which the wave propagates. And for vacuum or for air, that speed is very well characterized, and it's 300,000 kilometers per second, or 3 × 10⁻⁸ meters per second. So if you actually do the calculation and divide C here by 2.45 gigahertz, you get 12.2 centimeters, which is the wavelength at which the microwave operates. Any questions so far? So I want to move maybe to the first experiment. We can't see microwaves, but we can feel them using detectors. And that's what I would like to do, actually. So please come. This is a theoretical representation of what an electromagnetic wave is. And you could represent light like that. You could represent gamma rays, microwaves, radio waves. They're all the same. Electromagnetic waves are always the interplay between a magnetic field and an electric field. And that was discovered by Maxwell in the 19th century. And what's very interesting is that he discovered that by putting several laws together, that a time-varying magnetic field would induce an electric field, and a time-varying electric field would induce back a magnetic field. So essentially, if you can start a magnetic field, it will create, or an electric field that will create a magnetic field, and they will self-perpetuate and self-influence each other and propagate like that at the speed of light. And what's interesting is that the electric field component here, the red component, is always perpendicular to the magnetic field component, and that is the propagation direction. So if we try this, so here what we have is we have essentially a magnetron, just like in a microwave, only that it's a 10 gigahertz magnetron, so 4 times higher frequency. Here we have a diode that is going to be able to quickly pick up the electric field in space. And here we have a reflector, just like a piece of metal from the chamber here, that is going to reflect. This is essentially a wave cannon, and it's going to be reflected on this. And what will happen, essentially, is that we're going to create a standing wave. Just like, imagine that this is a guitar string, and we're going to just make it wiggle, and there's going to be a standing wave between these patterns here. And if we can stop the propagating wave and make it a standing wave, we should be able to see where the electric field is maximum and where it's minimum. So let's give it a try. So this is our voltage here. The magnetron is on, and then if we slowly move the diode laterally in between, we see variations in voltage. So the electromagnetic wave is actually standing right there at the moment. You can't see it, but it's there. And what you see, so if you move it around, then when you get, right now, I'm at a maximum of the sine wave of the electric field, and if I move a little further, a couple centimeters, actually corresponding to a wavelength, then I get to a minimum where I have minimal electric field. And if I go around, it's just going to oscillate up, down, up, down, up, down, as I move it closer to the end on the other side. So an electromagnetic field is something that you can actually feel using electronic instruments. It's very hard to feel it with your body at low intensities like that. This is a 50-watt system, so we'll describe what a watt is at the end of the presentation. Microwave ovens are typically a kilowatt in power, so you would definitely feel it if you put your hand in there. Any questions so far? Oh, the clickers are here. Well, too late. I think the hands. No, it's not too late. Okay, let's try it. I've never tried clickers, so. So in the meantime, while he distributes the clicker, I'd like to perform my very first experiment with the microwave. If I'm coming back a little here, you see that I talked about the metal casing, and just like the edge here, so the little metal plate here, what it does is it reflects the waves. So what a microwave does, actually, so it creates, the magnetron creates the wave, they're shot into the chamber here, and they bounce around. And they do exactly what happens here in one dimension, only that it happens in three dimensions here, is that there's a standing wave pattern that is created in 3D inside the microwave. And you can actually find where the maxima are. Well, we could put our diode in the microwave and just position it and see what the field is, but that's kind of hard. So we have a very low-tech way of doing that. Actually, what we take, let me go ahead a little. So we just took a bunch of bills from the local coffee shop at Polytechnique. And, well, that's not my coffee consumption, so look it on the web. And so, and essentially, you know how you print on this paper? It's actually a heat-sensitive paper, and it uses a thermal printer, so it basically comes with the numbers and heats up the paper, and it becomes dark. So what we'll do is spread all papers across the microwave and see where it becomes dark first, which means that's going to be the hot spots in the microwave. And where it stays white, then it's going to be the colder spots. So let's try that first. And let's see if we can film something from the microwave. And then we're going to put a light bulb in there. Very high-tech experiment. One.
Done
already? Cooked? So where are the hot spots?
We have one here.
Oh.
And not quite yet on the other side, so we can microwave a bit longer.
Okay, so when you do an extreme microwave experiment, you don't want to have a rotating tray to even out the power. You want to put your sample exactly where the hot spot is to get maximum power. So that's why we're trying always to characterize our scientific equipment before we use it. And if it were so scientific, we would like very much the hot spot to be right in the middle of the microwave, but unfortunately it's kind of on the side.
Small one here.
There's a small one here.
And bigger one there.
Okay, so.
So going on both.
Okay, so that's where we're going to put our stuff from now on. You can also do it with marshmallows. It's more fun, but it's harder to clean. You can just spread marshmallows in, and then you see which one just expand faster than the others. All right, so then, first real scientific experiment using a microwave. What if I put a light bulb in the microwave? Okay, this is, depending on what happens, we're going to be able to deduce some key scientific principles. And you have a couple of choices here, and let's see if those clickers work. I have no idea how it works, so Ariel, you tell me if I need to do something special. So, five choices. Yeah, so first what we're going to do, we're not going to put it by itself in the microwave, we're going to put it sitting in a glass of water. I'm going to tell you why after. But here are the choices. The bulb will light up just as if it were plugged. The bulb will blow up. So a bulb is actually, it's a vacuum chamber.
It works.
Okay. It works.
That's a new generation of clickers. You get the answer when you click.
So it doesn't seem to work. Okay.
But
well,
it would work to give the answer.
Okay, so let's give it a try now. Maybe nothing will happen. Maybe the experiment won't work. So.
But the bubble can blow up.
So the idea, the rationale behind my choices here is that you can actually have it blow up if you don't put water underneath. So you have to be careful. It's very thin glass. So the water is there to decrease the power in the microwave. Water absorbs the electromagnetic waves also so that you're not at maximum power. But it could blow up if you leave it long enough in the microwave. It could also become black, obviously. But here, hopefully, we'll have choice number one happening. And maybe choice number two. No. Okay, good.
Not
for today.
But choice number two is on the journal.
What?
We will meet.
Okay, so Wendy's telling me that choice number two is on the internet, and you can watch it. There's a website where we have some of these experiments here. All right, so first experiment, bulbs light up. Why is that? Any idea? Yeah?
Electricity goes through the water and lights up the bulb.
Electricity goes through the water. Actually, if we didn't put any water, it would still light up. So there's indeed some electricity involved. Yeah. Yes?
The magnetic field induces a current that travels through and lights up your light bulb.
There's a current induction, definitely. Not necessarily caused by the magnetic field, but potentially. Actually, they're caused by both the magnetic field and the electric field. This covers it pretty much. So essentially what happens, if you look at the standing wave inside the microwave, I'm looking at the electric field, but the magnetic field, by varying, would induce currents too, that's true. So you have your light bulb. This is the wavelength typical to the microwave here, 12.2 centimeters. And if my light bulb is somewhere in the microwave, and you have, you know, traveling waves all around, so when the wave crosses the light bulb, then there's a part of the wire or of the light bulb in general that's positively charged and another one that's negatively charged. And that oscillates very fast. And essentially what you have is you have current traveling on one side, on the other, on one side, on the other. And then you heat up the filament, the tungsten filament in the light bulb, and you create light. So scientifically speaking, this is a proof that you can actually induce currents in conductors using electromagnetic waves, using microwaves, for instance. So our first lesson then is you can induce magnetic currents in conductors using microwaves. Second experiment, or third one. What if I put now steel wool in the microwave? Okay, so you can get ready. Here are the choices. It will become red hot due to the induced currents. It will make sparks and smoke. Pretty self-explanatory. It will burn, light on fire. It will turn into sheep wool. Well, and nothing will happen. So let's see who thinks number one will happen. About 1/4 of the class. Number two, sparks and smoke. About 1/3. Burn. 1/10. And turn into sheep wool. You know, that would be very useful sometimes. And nothing will happen. No, yeah, you're convinced that something will happen, otherwise you wouldn't put it there. Okay, so let's try it. Let's switch to, just wait a second, Julie. So definitely smoke, certainly sparks, and a little bit of burning too, actually. So yeah, you have a video where you can leave it for much longer on the web to see that it eventually disappears, instead of vaporizes. Now why is that? How come it makes such huge sparks? No idea? Yes? The voltages cause arcing, indeed. And where particularly? Why is this wool actually emitting a lot of sparks? Sorry for the smoke. Oof, yeah. It does work. Well, there's a reason for that. Anyone heard of the Corona effect or St. Elmo's fire? Maybe sometimes if you're navigating on a sailboat, for example, and there's a little glow at the top of the mast. For example, this is the same effect, or on a plane. What happens is that if you have an object that is, so this is also St. Elmo's fire here. If you have an object at a given potential, that means this object, with reference to another object which is at ground, that object will have charges on it. And if this object so is everywhere the same potential, charges will try to be as far as each other as possible on a given object. So what happens is that they try to go, so charges go here, charges go below, and what happens is that you have this tendency to concentrate charges on the edges and tips of conducting objects. And that is what happens. I'll move to that very soon. So you get very high concentration of charges at edge and tips, and steel wool is essentially just a bunch of edges and tips everywhere, so that's why it reacts so violently in the microwave. And when you reach, so if you put a lot of charges, you induce very high electric fields, because fields are caused by charges. And when you get to a field that is close to about 3 million volts per meters, then this field is strong enough that it will ionize the surrounding air. And if the air gets ionized, then it will start glowing. And in this experiment, you can be sure that the field was much higher than 3 million volts per meter. And then you have lightning arcs going across different edges and tips in the steel wool. And that's the exact same principle here when you have lightning striking something. So first there's usually a tip of a conducting object here, you know, typical golf club, and this will create a very high electric field at the edge, and also so I had fun in my electromagnetics class where this is a very simple modeling software that you can use, and so I just drew a conducting guy here with a club here, and what you can see actually, so the fact that these lines are very close, these are isopotential lines, so when they're very close to each other, oh, thank you,
you.
So right here, you have lots. It's a bit like on a topographical map. So when the lines are very close together, the slope is very strong. That means that there's a very high electric field right here between my simulated cloud and my edge here. And when you get this very strong field here, you run the chance of ionizing the air. So, and when the air gets ionized, it becomes conducting. And once, and usually when lightning strikes, what happens before is you have a tracer. What we call a tracer, it's basically a channel of ionized air that establishes itself between the clouds or whatever charge object there is and the conducting person here. And when this channel has established itself, then lightning goes through, because now air is conducting, it's no longer an insulator, and you get the discharge, and that's where it's really dangerous. So essentially, that's what we've created with steel wool in our system. Experiment number 4. What if I put a tuna can inside the microwave? Several choices. The tuna will be cooked once the can is opened. The can will deform under the pressure and might burst. The can will emit sparks and become hot, but the tuna won't be cooked. Okay, so this can, you have to know that it's a conductor, right? It's a thin can, so it conduces electricity. Yes, you had a question? Okay. And this is actually a very interesting one that I got at the Festival Eureka in 2009 from a kid. So the tuna will come back to life and jump out of the can. And one day I told myself I would like prepare the can and put like a little live fish in there and just, and open it and it'll jump out of the can. And nothing will happen. So who thinks, number one? No one is going to expect to have to cook tuna after putting it in the microwave. The can will deform under pressure and might burst. So we're going to put it, how long are we going to put it, Judy?
Well,
2 minutes maybe?
We'll bring the microwave. Well, for 30 seconds.
30 seconds? Okay. The can will emit sparks, but the tuna won't be cooked. Most people, like two-thirds, the tuna will come back to life and jump out of the can. Wow, I'm surprised. And nothing will happen. So, no one thinks nothing will happen. So let's try it. And hopefully we're going to be able to show another important physics principle using this can.
We'll need someone to...
You need someone to?
To check the
heat. Oh, yeah. And so we're going to take it out, and then we need someone to check the temperature of the can. Any volunteer? One here? Good.
Great. Well, for now.
So, first of all, it's cold. There's no trick.
It's cold.
It's cold. And fire. Oh, that was a leftover from the steel wool. First one was that it was going to burst. I know the second one. So there's always a problem doing these experiments, because if you look actually at the back of the microwave, it says minimal load inside the chamber, 275 milliliters of water. You shouldn't be putting anything less than 275 milliliters. And what happens is actually that if there's nothing inside, oh, check it.
Hot either.
It's not really hot?
It's still coldish.
Coldish, or has it warmed up even a little?
Barely.
Barely?
Yeah, I can't know if you had it different.
It seems warmer.
But I didn't touch it. Yeah. Actually, it's not warm at all. And if we were not afraid of breaking our microwave, because there's actually nothing inside when we put this, nothing that can be heated, then you would see that after 2 minutes, 3 minutes, it's still room temperature. So the right answer this time is nothing happens. And there's a reason for that. And actually, it's one of these inconclusive experiments that are very interesting scientifically. Now that you know the answer, do you have any idea of why nothing happens? Faraday cage, yes, that's the key word. What is a Faraday cage?
Like, there's no field inside an enclosed...
There's no field inside the can, no field inside the enclosed chamber. And why is that? It's true. There are no, actually, if you would measure inside, the tuna never saw any electromagnetic radiation. Why is that? Yeah?
It's made of metal, so it shields the radiation.
Yeah, it's made of metal. So the metal contains the waves inside the microwave, but also contains the wave outside the tuna. So essentially, the tuna is in a special pocket outside the microwave, even though it's inside, because it's shielded from the outside. So all the waves bounce around, but never actually get to the tuna. So you get cold tuna. And this is, so it's really not a good idea to heat up a tin can in the microwave, simply because it doesn't work. Now, if you were to open it and you lift a little lid, you would have edges around this lid, and I'm pretty sure it would spark all over the place. So this is really also because the tuna can doesn't have any edges and tips, as I mentioned. Well, it does have the little side here, but apparently it's not enough to create these high electric fields and ionize the air. So interesting. And Faraday cages actually work at about every frequency. Here there's actually a website called faradaycage.com where they tried all sorts. And here you have a Van de Graaff generator and some guy sitting in a cage. And the cage is grounded. And essentially, so all the current goes inside the cage, actually in the metal wires, stays outside, and the guy doesn't feel the electric field inside. And that's very interesting. Because there's we could try this experiment again so I can show you polarization. I forgot to do it earlier. So let's switch to video, please.
Yep.
I'll show you some interesting experiments regarding the polarization of electromagnetic waves. So we have this standing wave here, and now what we're going to do is we're going to put these metal wires. This is like a comb, essentially. And they're just conducting wires. And we're going to show with that the wave here is polarized. So if I put, let's film the meter, please, the voltmeter. Okay. So let's go to a maximum. Okay, here, for example. And then what if I put this comb with the tips up here? See? It completely kills the wave. So essentially what it means is that the wave is being induces currents in these wires, and the currents induced counter-induce a wave in the other direction, which essentially, so that all waves on this side are canceled and don't exist anymore. So first lesson, remember that it induces currents, and now these induced currents in turn induce a reflected wave in here. And what's very interesting, if you go back to the meter, please, to the voltmeter, what's very interesting is that this way it kills a wave, but if you flip it and use the comb horizontally, then nothing happens. So it only works when you put it vertical. Like that. And if you put it like 45 degrees, let's see if it works. It's probably going to, yeah, it kills it. Most of it, yeah. So, but if I put it this way, then it does work. So what happens here is that it shows that the electric field is polarized. So when I showed you the electromagnetic wave with the electric field and the magnetic field, these wires here will stop the electric field when the electric field is parallel to the wire, And when it's perpendicular, they won't stop it. And that's exactly what why you have a Faraday cage in your microwave, because if you can see that there's a grid here, there's a mesh of metal wires, and that's what actually stops the waves. It's not the glass. The waves would go through the glass very easily, but the metal mesh here is actually a combination of a comb like that and a comb like that, so that for sure the wave is absorbed by the mesh and then re-emitted, reflected inside. And so that is essentially a Faraday cage. So this whole microwave here is a Faraday cage. And what's funny, as I told you, is that cell phones have pretty much the same wavelength as microwaves. So let's try an experiment. If you want to see if your microwave is actually a very good insulator, so very good Faraday cage. So Julie, let me call you for control first. Second. We do get good signal here in the basement. It's quite surprising. Okay. And now let's put it inside. And we didn't try that before, actually. We just discussed it. So we're going to get the live results. So I'm calling you.
I'm on a video.
Okay. Well, so it's actually a very good Faraday cage. But you know what? Try it at home. Don't start the microwave, by the way. If you try it at home, it's very likely that it's going to work. I'm actually surprised right now that this is not working, because cell phones are extremely sensitive piece of equipment. They can feel electromagnetic waves in the femtometer, 10 to the negative 15, femtowatts, 10 to the negative 15 watts. So very, very low. So sometimes, outside microwave, even though you're in a Faraday cage, you do get milliwatts per square meter of power around the outside. That's not dangerous. It's very low power. But here, well, apparently this one is a very good one. So good choice, guys. Come up.
Because that's what I heard, that, in fact, for people that are scared about microwaves, this is one way to check that they don't leak, is to put your cell phone in. And if it doesn't ring, then it means the shielding is good.
So, if you want the thing, so what Ariel is saying is that a good way to test the shielding is to put your cell phone in. If it doesn't ring, the shielding is good. But if it does ring, it might scare people. So I'm not giving this trick for you to try, because if it does ring, then you might be scared for nothing, because maybe you have milliwatts or microwatts per square meter leaching out of your microwave because of, nothing's perfect. There are some edges and, the waves find their way out for some reason. But that doesn't mean it's dangerous, okay? It just means that you have a little leak, but you have kilowatts of power inside and a million times less outside, so it does kill a lot. But those things are extremely sensitive, so if you try at home and it works, doesn't mean that the microwave is not protecting, that the Faraday cage is not protecting. Oh yeah, your question, Vine, sorry.
Just the rumor that when you stand in front of a microwave that's on, you can get cancer, is that true at all?
Okay, we're going to discuss it at the end of this talk. Okay? So, and I just want to check time, so we've still got 30 minutes for the rest of the talk. That's good. So, another thing that is related to Faraday cage, actually, is the reason why you lose AM radio in a tunnel while you still keep FM radio, if you go to the Highway 25 and, down the Louis-Polyte-Lafontaine tunnel. You might lose FM at the middle, but most of the time you can hear most of it while you lose AM in the first meters when you get in the tunnel. Why is that? First, anyone with a pocket calculator, could you please calculate what the wavelength of CJAD 800 kilohertz on the AM channel, what is the wavelength of that one? And someone else, please calculate what is the wavelength of CBC Radio 1 at 88.5 megahertz. So 88.5 hertz. And I remind you that you divide C, so the speed of light, 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second, by the frequency in hertz to get the wavelength in meters. So I don't know it by heart. Anyone's doing it? So 300 million divided by 800,000 here, and 300 million divided by 88.5 million on the other side. Yeah.
That's
375 meters. It's a very long wavelength. So if you have this diode detector here, you would need to walk a long time to see a maximum and a minimum for AM radio waves. What about FM? So about 100 times less. So FM waves are 3.3 meters long. So they're longer, lower energy than microwaves. And AM waves are 300 meters long. So what happens here is essentially a Faraday cage system, because there's a rule of thumb. Did I show it here? No, I didn't explain it, but I showed it. There's a rule of thumb to see if your Faraday cage is useful against a certain type of radiation, is that the size of the holes in the cage has to be much smaller than the wavelength. Okay, so here we have 12 centimeter wavelength, we have millimeter size holes, we're okay. Here we have a tunnel. A tunnel, you could see it as a hole leading to some chamber on the other side, and that hole is about what, like 30 meter on the side, so that FM radio waves fit in and AM radio waves don't fit in. So they basically get reflected, just like, because concrete conducts electricity a little bit at least, enough to deflect that wave, and you don't get AM waves getting in. So a tunnel acts like a Faraday cage for these very long wavelengths, and not for FM. And that is actually the reason why you don't lose FM radio in a tunnel, and you do lose AM. Now I want to move on to some... Yes, question.
I just don't understand if there were like any like holes in the tunnel that the wavelengths should go through.
So actually the tunnel would be like one of the holes in that grid.
Oh, the opening.
So you would... Just to see the Faraday cage, you would have to put thousands of tunnels in parallel like that, and they would each be one of these little holes in here. But you only have one hole, you know, so they don't get through that hole. Yeah.
So how do you do cell phone signals?
Well, cell phone signals have wavelengths of 12 centimeters, so they easily get into the tunnel.
Right, so why do you lose signals?
Well, the reason why you lose it might be because the antennas are placed in such a way that they don't get access, or you only get reflections from the waves inside the tunnel, and they're much diminished. So that is one of the reasons why you lose it. So let's move on to some more extreme microwave physics. This time I want to use graphite and glass. And what we're going to do is use LEDs, essentially 0.7 millimeters, that are 6 centimeter long, so just right here. So, and we just plant them into some candle just for support so that they stick out vertically. Put 4 of them, and we're going to put a glass, an empty glass, actually a beer glass, on top of it inside the microwave, right on top of the hot spot. And here are the choices. What will happen in there? And we're putting a glass cover because glass is somehow important here. Somehow. So the graphite will melt, but the glass will not be affected. both the glass and the graphite will melt. Okay, and then we're going to keep molten glass.
Neutral.
The graphite will become red, hot, and glow. Ball lightning. So if you don't know what ball lightning is what you have in Tintin and seven crystal balls or something like that. C'est boule de cristal in French. Where you actually have these weird atmospheric phenomenon where you have lightning in the shape of a ball, and this is actually what we also call a plasma in physics. Or nothing will happen, and I'm just making that for
can we
so, who thinks one will occur? Graphite will melt. So, I would guess then that no one thinks that both glass and graphite will melt. Who thinks that graphite will become red hot and glow? Majority. Who thinks we will create ball lightning in there? One, two person. Interesting. Who thinks nothing will happen? Well, it's always a good guess, you know, maybe it's not going to work. This one actually sometimes doesn't work, but we have video backups. Okay, so let's put these graphite. I'll tell you why we use graphite here in a minute. So right on top of the hotspot, we want maximum power this time. Okay. Usually what happens is that, yeah, so you make a mess. Actually, what you've just witnessed is what we call ball lightning. And you can actually explain it in a way, and I'll show you a video in a second that is much more eloquent than this one, which was a, I would say, half success. But we have to be careful for one reason. So what we've put is graphite in there. And why graphite? Because graphite has edges, so it's going to create sparks. It's a conductor, but a very poor conductor. So it heats up a lot in the process and emits graphite, essentially carbon atoms. It just fills the glass with carbon atoms. And now the microwaves goes in there, you get sparks, you get ionized carbon atoms inside the glass. And when you have ionized, you know what, if you don't know what an ion is, it's basically an atom that is charged because it lost some of its electrons. So if you have an ionized carbon atom or several of them and a microwave field, they just fluctuate and so the microwave field influences the charges and they move around and they bounce into each other and lose more electrons, become more charged and ionize the air, and you get with what you call a plasma inside. And actually this is, you know, this one of the, actually the ball lightning phenomenon is something that is very, I would say, is on the border of the paranormal, something that we haven't really reproduced experimentally, but most people think it's just witnessing a plasma ball that arises, you know, after lightning has struck. And here's a little video that actually one very successful one that we did in the same conditions. And actually, so we had a very nice microwave before to do these experiments, but someone did a plasma ball without putting a glass on it, and it bore a hole on the top of the microwave. Why? Because it's extremely hot. Okay, and this is one of the most dangerous experiments you can make in the microwave. And actually, at one time, we let it for some time, and the graphite touched the glass, and right at the tip, we had, it actually melted the glass away.
It happened, so they want you to come.
It happened here?
Yeah.
Really?
That's why it didn't work. So
that's why it didn't work. Okay, so the graphite fell and it actually melted. And if you actually compute the temperature inside a plasma, you usually get that it's higher than 10,000 degrees Celsius for air plasmas. And this is sufficiently hot to melt about anything, including glass. Okay, so this is one of the most dangerous experiments that you can make. And there's a reason why we chose these graphite leads. They're 6 centimeters long. Can you tell me why I chose something that is specifically 6 centimeters long? And actually, if you would try 4, it probably wouldn't work. If you tried a quarter, so actually, well, half that, 3 centimeters, it would also work, but it's a bit trickier. Why is that? It's half of the wavelength. And when you make antennas for emitting or receiving microwaves, you have two choices. Typically, for the simplest antennas, you have half wavelength antenna and quarter wavelength antenna, because they're the. And why is that? Because if you have this and you have a traveling wave, well, with 6 centimeter, this is the length at which you can get on one side the highest positive charge and on the other side the highest negative charge. So you can get the highest voltage difference across the graphite here. And this voltage difference induces currents going back and forth and creates lots of energy under the form of a plasma. Okay? But this is not limited only to graphite. Let's try it with some more mundane objects. And so some people have reported, actually, in, you know, like people calling microwave companies saying, well, I put my, you know, my carrots in the microwave and they started sparking and, you know, like emitting fire, and I don't understand what's happening. And this is something that actually occurs. But you have to be extra careful to make it happen. So did you put the carrots inside the... So here's what we did. We took quarter wavelength carrots. So you have to be precise. And then chew the part inside. And one of the reasons why I chose Etienne and Julie is not only because they're excellent engineers, but also because they have very nice parabolic tooth marks so that they can bite on that and make the section thinner inside. And why do we want this section as thin as possible? Well, because if you put a voltage difference here, you want to have maximized current. You want to have a very high current density. So if you make it smaller, all the current will go through that section. It's going to heat up more. So this experiment doesn't always work. We have backup videos, but let's try it.
Little carrots.
Putting them on the hot spots. Put them everywhere, actually. But the ones on the hot spots are more likely to work. So for those of you who didn't know that carrots can actually be good conductors, if they're fresh and very juicy. If they're old, they become very poor conductors. So now I hear some cooking, but not what we want.
No.
Okay. Can you try just one carrot with a very thin section right on top of the hot spot? The other one's also absorbing the energy, so if we have only one carrot, then we'll maximize the absorbed energy in that one. See if this works. If not, we'll go to backup video number one.
Nope.
Nope. Carrots do not behave well this morning. but they're cooked, so if anyone's hungry. Okay, so let's move to backup video because we, for the sake of time. So here's one. You can see the sparks on the edges, and even with the gap in between, current gets to pass and create this lightning. Interesting, huh? So it takes a little more time, but we managed to do it. You can also do it with raisins. I mean, with grapes. So this is a grape cut in half and hanging by just a little thread of skin in between the two sides of the grape, like this, so that current can pass through. Also very juicy, lots of ions, so it's a conducting solution. And there's no trick, there's no wire in there or anything. It just happens.
You can see it's boiling.
And now it's boiling, yeah. Yeah. The result's not very tasty. Okay, so plasmas actually can occur with anything that is conducting. Quarter wavelength or half wavelength are the ones that work best. And I want to conclude this. Yeah, question.
When the graphite, why was there a hole at the top of the glass?
Why was there a hole at the...
Why wasn't there?
Well, because if you're at the tip of the graphite lead, then you have very high voltage there, very high electric field, and most likely plasma was concentrated at the tip here, and the energy density was highest at this edge. You had a lot of energy on top, and it would certainly etch the glass slowly with time. But, you know, we didn't, this is my take on things like that, but we didn't do any measurements to see what happens, but I figured that this happens. And another thing you can do, if we didn't do it, but we could have done it, is you take a blowtorch and heat up a beer bottle on the side so that it becomes glowing red. Then you'll have ionized SiO2 in there, so it's going to be emitting light. And then if you put that bottle in the microwave, you'll create a plasma locally where it's heated up, and it's going to etch a hole in the bottle right where it's red hot, just because of the same reason where you have the highest energy there. There's lots of cool things you can do with the microwave. So finally, the experiment that you can do at home, which I titled Cleaning Up Your Mess. A good thing, your mom will love that experiment. Which involves one very specific kind of soap, doesn't work with any. It works with ivory soap, the one that claims that it's the soap that floats. So, when you want to clean up your mess, you just take it. No need even to unwrap the soap. Actually, the cleaning up experiment is the messiest one. and that's why we do it at the end, but it brings, you know, very nice fragrance. And yeah, you can... So maybe we can pass it around. It's a bit hot, so be careful.
but it makes this very elegant foam.
Take a piece and pass it
on. Give us a gift, you know.
So what happens here? And why do we need the soap that floats from ivory for that to work?
This one's actually very simple. There's a reason why ivory soap floats. You know why?
There are lots of air bubbles inside. So it's made, it's like, it's whipped so that it's very light. Lots of air bubbles. Well, it also allows them to sell bigger soap with less ingredients, so make more money. And there, it's filled with air bubbles, and when you heat up the soap, you actually, those bubbles want to expand, and they make the soap expand and make this foam-like substance. Question, yes?
I have a question. Why is it the foam like appear mostly on the right side instead of the left when you said the hot spots?
I don't think we put that one on the hotspot, Rodrigo. Did you put it on the hotspot?
On the right hotspot that didn't appear at the beginning, but small. But only one soap worked. So the one, there was no soap on the left hotspot.
So. Okay, so only the one on the hotspot worked.
Yeah.
Okay, so well, the power was highest there, but I just threw the other one and probably didn't land in a very good spot. But essentially, it's because, you know, it's wrapped, and one of the sides of the wrapping was weaker than the other one, and so with the pressure buildup, it just blew up one side of the wrapping and less the other one, and that's the only reason. All right, so before I get to my summary, I have 5 more minutes. That's very little to do. Anyway, if you give me 10, I think I can go through the presentation. Any questions at this point? All right, so if I want to summarize what we've seen today with all these microwave experiments, well, there's some quite interesting physics going on there. First one is that we saw using the light bulb that, we saw that microwaves are electromagnetic waves. Then the relationship with the frequency, they induce currents. We saw that in conductors. We saw that with the light bulb. They induce very high electric fields. We saw that with the steel wool and the plasma. So they can create and sustain plasma. They're reflected by conductors. So currents are induced in the conductors, but that has the effect of reflecting the wave once the current is dissipated. So we do have reflected, so there's presence of Faraday cage, so we saw the concept of what is a Faraday cage. And in the end, they can force non-conducting material to expand under heat effects, and that's what we saw with the soap. But what I want to do in the last 10 minutes, bear with me please, is that what is curious is that cell phones, Wi-Fi routers, Bluetooth technology just all operate at the same frequency than a microwave. So the question is, are we in danger? And could I have created a plasma with 2 cell phones inside a glass jar with graphite, for example? Well, many people say that microwaves around us are dangerous. And here are their claims. They're a form of pollution that we often, I don't, but many people call electrosmog in relationship with regular smog, which is atmospheric pollution. They can induce cancer. That was a question behind at the beginning. Some people are hypersensitive to them and develop these symptoms when they're exposed to electromagnetic fields. Attention deficit disorder, increased heart rates, headaches, nausea, anxiety. Well, I'm pretty sure if you would stand inside a microwave, you would develop all these symptoms. The question is, if you're talking to your cell phone, why does this happen? And it's actually been reported in certain individuals. And finally, some claim that it can influence your brain, since your brain is a bioelectric machine, and same with your heart. It can also influence your heart rate, because your heart isn't a bioelectric machine, and if you send waves on that, well, maybe it does something. And if you look at typical antenna for example, here, this is the top of Radio Canada. You have the CBC HDTV antenna here, 100 kilowatts. That's 100 microwaves in power. The French one, 250 microwave power. So that's a lot of power. And if you would sit right by, you would probably cook. That's very likely. And that's why they're high and they're surrounded by a fence. But now, there's a big difference between a microwave and these antenna and a cell phone, and that is power. It's the same wavelength, but power is everything. So here's a little chart of what the powers are. TV antenna, yeah, as I mentioned, 100 to 300 kilowatts. Microwave oven, about a kilowatt. Cell phones. Cell phones, it depends. The emission will depend on how far you are from the nearest antenna. So if the antenna is really close, your cell phone is going to emit at lower power. If it's several kilometers away, then it will reach a maximum of approximately 1 watt. For the largest cell phones, actually. Typically, it's less than 0.1 watt. And what about Wi-Fi routers? Well, they have maximum powers around 0.1 watt. And the USB port of your computer, I remind you, is a 2.5 watt port. So this is everything. So now what is a watt? Of course, with a kilowatt, you can boil water, and you could probably boil your brain out if you put your head in there, find a not-so-clever way to keep the microwave working while the door is open. But here's what a watt is. So 4.2 watts, 4.2 joules per second, is actually the amount of power required to heat up a kilogram of water by 1 millidegree Celsius. In 1 second, if there were no heat dissipation whatsoever in what you're heating up. That means, if you look at Health Canada's norm, and all cell phones, all the environment abides by these norms. So this is very well respected in our society. So and near antennas, there are fences so that you never exceed such norms. And here's what the maximum wattage in the environment actually that can be absorbed by the human body is. Health Canada says that in any uncontrolled environment, city, university, anywhere, actually where civilians, people with no restrictions are admitted, well, there shouldn't be exposed, they shouldn't get more than 0.08, so 80 milliwatts per kilogram of energy coming from that radiation. So how much is that? Well, if you do the calculation, very simple physics, well, if your body did not dissipate any heat, then that means you would heat up by 0.00002 Celsius per second. Even after an hour of exposure at these levels, your body temperature wouldn't have risen by 1 Celsius. And you know very well that when you have fever, it rises much more than 1 degree Celsius. So you can certainly handle that. This is a very, very small number. So the norms are actually very conservative. And Health Canada's norm are actually, what they claim is that they're 50 times below anything that has ever been reported to have an effect on you. And on top of that, what's very interesting is we have blood circulation. We emit constantly radiate power ourselves. And our body naturally dissipates heat at approximately a rate of approximately 75 watts. So we're very well equipped to dissipate these very little amounts of energy. But still, some people claim that there are some studies that claim that cell phones can cause brain cancer, for example. And there are some studies, some people are very afraid of their microwave, of standing in front, when you know that there might be a leakage power on the order of the milliwatt that can be measured outside a microwave. So the other thing we need to understand about electromagnetic waves in the environment is that the further you are from a source, the smaller the intensity is. And how do you measure that? Well, actually, if you have an antenna that emits 1 kilowatt, if you stand at 1 meter of that antenna, say it's a microwave antenna here, all the kilowatt of energy will be distributed, and that is a rough approximation, but let's suppose that the wavefront is spherical. all the kilowatt of energy will cross the shell of a sphere with a 1 meter radius. Now the same energy expands in the environment. So if you stand at 100 meters of the antenna, all the energy will be spread out on a shell that is has 1 meter radius. And if you're a kilometer away from the antenna, you have all this energy spread out on here. So if you're here, you only absorb the amount of energy that's located near you. And that's about, if you're at a kilometer from a kilowatt antenna, that is about 0.8 milliwatt. If you shoot that up to 100 kilowatt, like CBC, HDTV, then you would get, 80 milliwatts per square meter, which is very, very, it's much less actually than your cell phone. So what's very important is that wave intensity varies with the inverse square power of the distance. That's because of that spherical shell rule right here. And then you can draw some conclusions, and give me 2 more minutes and I'll cover these with you, actually. Here are some things you can answer to people who are afraid of getting cancer from using their cell phone or from using the router, or even worse, because it's much less energy, the smart meters from Hydro-Quebec that we hear about these days. That if there's one thing that you should be worried of in regular appliances that you have at home, it's your cell phone. Why? Because it's very close from your head, so that, if you take this spherical model, then you get most of the power radiated through your head, actually about half of it, but it's still a very low power source. So if you have to worry about something, it's the cell phone. The Wi-Fi routers are hundreds of times less intensity than a cell phone, and you're not close to it, and the smart meters are even lower. Okay, so let's worry about cell phones. Let's see what the literature says about cell phones. If nothing is said about cell phones, then you can infer that the same thing is true for the meters and the routers.